Nature uses an ingenious device called sex to operate a sort of genetic lottery. Each one of us has a set of genetic characteristics that we inherit from our parents. Our parents have a large number of genes, and there's a random sorting of genes in each egg and each sperm that they produce. No two sperm, no two eggs from the same person are likely to have just exactly the same set of genes. Otherwise, a man and a woman would keep having genetically the same types of children. Well, this random sorting of genes, when we reproduce, means that we will produce individuals with a wide diversity of genetic characteristics. It's sort of a lottery, in a way, and it means that this random sorting of genes, some people are going to fare differently than others. And it also means that there will be some people who will get genetic characteristics that place them at disadvantage with some other people. Our price for this genetic diversity has changed somewhat over the centuries. We used to have a situation which is sometimes characterized as survival of the fittest. That is, nature used to operate with a fairly ruthless efficiency, so that those individuals who happened to have characteristics that put them at a disadvantage in terms of reproducing did not pass their genes on to the next generation. And so over a long period of time, those individuals who had genetic characteristics that were favorable in terms of being able to reproduce, they contributed the most to the genetic characteristics in the next generation. Well, natural selection still operates, but not quite as ruthlessly as it once did. We've greatly improved our medical care. People now are able to have a much higher quality of life than they once did, despite having genetic disadvantages. And increasingly, people have the opportunity, along with that increased quality of life, of reproducing and passing on then to the next generation the genetic characteristics that they carry. Our style of life also means that we are exposed to agents that can cause genetic damage, radiation, synthetic compounds that we consume as food additives. A Nobel laureate at Stanford has estimated that 80% of the genetic damage that we undergo, that is when we're exposed to outside agents that can damage genes, cause mutations, 80% of these are due to environmental factors, which at least in theory we could do something about. And of course, if this genetic damage happens to an egg or a sperm cell, then this can be reflected in the characteristics of our offspring. There's some statistics about genetic disorders which are, at least to me, rather striking. There are more than 2,000 diseases that are considered to have at least a partial genetic component. We'll go through several categories. They account for 1/4 to 1/3 of all hospitalizations of children. There are about 250,000 children born each year in the United States with birth defects, the majority of which have at least a partial genetic component. 50 years ago, infectious diseases were a much greater threat than they are now. We have antibiotics and other medicines. They're still a threat, but the childhood deaths have been diminished from this threat. 50 years ago, about 60% of all childhood deaths came from infectious diseases. Only 2 to 3% of the deaths came from genetic disorders. Now that infectious diseases have been brought under some degree of control, about 12% of childhood deaths are now from genetic disorders. That's in the U.S. Yeah. The medical care, of course, isn't uniform throughout the world. there, when we look at statistics of individuals with genetic disorders, in a sense that's only the tip of the iceberg, because that doesn't take into account all the individuals who are carrying genetic disorders that aren't showing up in those individuals. A common guesstimate is that every one of us carries, on the average, probably 4 to 8 genetic disorders. It may not show up in us because some genetic disorders are recessive. Genes come in pairs, and if you have one that carries a disorder paired with a normal one, for many types of disorders it doesn't show up. But our offspring will inherit one of that pair, and it might be the one that's normal, it might be the one that isn't normal, and then they'll also inherit one of that particular kind of gene from the other parent, and then the chances, there's a certain risk factor that you get a pairing. I'll show you some of the genetic situations and what the risk factors are. But if we're interested not only in how many individuals have genetic disorders, but what percentage of the genes in us, in the human population, are abnormal. And I use these words with difficulty because our definition of normal and abnormal is difficult. There's a concern that we have a sort of a genetic time bomb on our hands. That is, we are all carrying disorders. Increasing numbers of people have an opportunity to reproduce who have disorders. Those individuals we provide medical care for. Potentially there's a problem that downstream an increasing percentage of conceptions will be embryos, fetuses, where there is a genetic disorder present. A geneticist at Yale has summarized the dilemma like this. If we enable the weak and the deformed to live and to propagate their kind, we face the prospect of a genetic twilight. But if we let them die or suffer when we can save or help them, we face the certainty of a moral twilight. In some cases, there may be a conflict of interest between what is good for the individual right now and what is good downstream many generations in terms of the genetic constitution of our population. Now, I have quite a few slides, and I'd like to show you some information about genetic disorders. When we talk about genetic disorders, for convenience, they are often put into three categories. And the first category is called chromosome disorders. These are genetic conditions whereby looking at the chromosomes, and I'll show you in a minute a slide of what it looks like when you can visualize the chromosomes. When you look at the chromosomes, you can see that there's an abnormal pattern. Now, humans have 22 pairs of chromosomes plus either two X chromosomes for females or an X chromosome and a Y chromosome for males. Some of the chromosome abnormalities are indicated here. Up there at the top, you see trisomy 21, trisomy 18, trisomy 13. That means you have three instead of the usual pair of chromosomes. And the number 13, 18, or 21, that's just a system for numbering chromosomes and identifying them. I'll show you a situation of trisomy 21. That's Down syndrome, formerly termed Mongolism, one of the more common ones. And there are also, among the chromosome disorders, fairly commonly sex chromosomes are involved, the X or the Y chromosome. You see down near the bottom, XXY, XXX, XYY. Those all involve an extra sex-linked chromosome. If we take a look at the chromosomes, this is something called a karyotype. And there's a conventional way that geneticists use now to fix the chromosomes, take pictures of them. The pattern is up there at the top. Then they cut out the chromosomes, arrange them in a particular order, really of decreasing size. And in the lower half of the slide, you see chromosomes 1, 2, 3, and on through 22. And then in the lower right-hand corner, you see two X chromosomes. This would be a female. And if you look at the chromosome pattern, you see pairs of chromosomes for each of those numbers. Now, this would be a normal type of pattern. There is no, at least, gross chromosome abnormality evident here. If we take a look at this slide, on the left is a normal karyotype. It just looks a little different because they've used a different staining technique here. You can see down in the lower right-hand corner of the portion on the left that this is a male. There's an X chromosome and a Y chromosome. The Y chromosome is quite a bit smaller. Can you see in the pattern on the right something unusual? Yeah, if you look at chromosome number 21, you see three of them instead of two. And this is what a karyotype of someone with Down syndrome might show. Now, there's more than one type of Down syndrome, but this is the most common type. White blood cells, yeah. Red blood cells don't have nuclei, and yeah. Now, that's one category of genetic disorders where you can actually, by looking at the chromosomes, you can see that there's too many or too few, or I didn't show you this. There are also disorders where a piece of a chromosome is broken off and connected somewhere else. Another kind of genetic disorder is much more subtle. If you looked at the chromosome pattern of these individuals, you wouldn't see anything unusual. But what's happening is that there is a single gene that, in many cases here, a pair of genes that carry faulty information as far as a cell making a certain product. And many of the disorders you see on this list are fairly well-known ones. We see cystic fibrosis, which is about the most common one among the white population in the United States. Down the list, there's phenylketonuria. That's a disorder that is screened for in infants routinely. Tay-Sachs disease there is most common among certain ethnic group, Ashkenazi Jews. There is another group down there under X-linked. I'll explain what that means in a little bit, but a common form of muscular dystrophy and hemophilia is in that category. And then also there are some so-called dominant disorders, some of which are indicated there. Now, I should maybe distinguish what's the difference between a gene and a chromosome. These are called monogenic disorders. If you look at the top line, monogenic, a single gene. A chromosome is much bigger than a gene. You've seen how many chromosomes we have from the pattern. An estimate is that there are 40 to 100,000 different genes in a human being. And these are arranged among those chromosomes. So a single chromosome has a lot of different genes on it. And if any one of those genes has faulty information, it can result in a disorder such as the ones indicated here. But if you just look at the chromosome itself, you won't see that there's something amiss. There are certain chemical tests that can be done to, in some of these cases, to detect the disorder. Now, the third category, these are called multifactorial, and this is sort of a catch-all that's used for disorders that really aren't understood very well. Some of the fairly common disorders, percentage-wise, are in this category. Spina bifida, those numbers over on the right-hand side, that's the percentage, the frequency of this occurring. This is in the U.S. But down below, common diseases, diabetes, malignancy, allergies, these are disorders where there seems to be a genetic component, there seems to be an environmental component. It really means nobody's figured out exactly what the problem is, but they're put into this category. If you add all those disorders, three categories of disorders together, you get down there at the bottom right-hand corner roughly about 3% incidence, adding this all up. Okay, what can we do about this in terms of at least prevention. One service that is rapidly expanding is called genetic counseling. There are now over 400 centers in the United States where genetic counseling is available. This is a service for people primarily who think they have an unusually high risk of having a child with a disorder. In many cases, these are couples who have already had a child with a disorder, or they know from their family history, they're concerned that they may have a high risk of a disorder. Also, women who are over 35 are often advised to get counseling because Down syndrome is more common, and I'll show you that relationship in a little bit. Also, women who have had two or more miscarriages are sometimes advised to get genetic counseling because a miscarriage may occur because of some abnormality in the embryo or fetus, and it might be a sign that there's something amiss. Also, if the husband and wife are related by blood, there's a higher risk of genetic disorders. Well, when the clients come in for genetic counseling, the first task is to take as complete a genetic history as possible of the spouses to try to pinpoint what their genetic situation is, that is to determine if they are carriers for a particular disorder that they might be concerned about. There are also tests, medical tests that can be done on individuals to determine if they are carriers for some disorders. Not by any means for all disorders, but some of the disorders where there is a test that can be done to diagnose carriers are indicated here. Unfortunately, there are some fairly common ones that are missing from the list, things like cystic fibrosis, muscular dystrophy. There are not good carrier tests, at least not highly reliable ones available yet. Once the information is gotten about what the genetic situation of the prospective parents is, then the genetic counselor can calculate some risk factors. If the disorder that they're concerned about, now usually when people come in for genetic counseling, there's one particular disorder that they're concerned about because of having had a child with a disorder or because of family history or something, and generally the work is focusing on this particular disorder. There are so many disorders, you can't come in and get a complete genetic check for everything that potentially could show up. If the disorder is a recessive disorder, now a recessive, as we talked about, means that if you have one gene that's normal paired with another gene that's abnormal, the normal one can compensate, cover up, if you will. Those people won't have the disorder. The only way you have it is if both of your genes have the disorder in the pair. Well, if one of the parents is a carrier, and yellow here indicates a carrier, and if one of the prospective parents is not a carrier, and you work out the genetic crosses, the bottom line really tells you what the risk factor is. The risk factor is about 50% for a child being a carrier, 50% for a child not being a carrier, but in neither case are you going to have a child with a disorder if only one parent is involved as a carrier. If both parents are carriers for the same disorder, and this would include a number of disorders, Tay-Sachs disease, cystic fibrosis would be two such examples. If both parents are carriers, and if you work out the genetics of it, down there on the bottom line you see the risk factor, there's a 25% risk or likelihood that the child will neither be a carrier nor have the disorder. 2 out of 4, a 50% risk that the child will be a carrier, a 1 in 4 chance that the child will have the disorder if both parents are carriers for the same disorder. Now, these are risk factors. Each child, it's a fresh odds. It's like flipping a coin. Each time you flip it, it's 50% chance of getting heads, and it doesn't matter what happened on the previous flip. So a couple having children, these are the odds on each child, regardless of how other children fared with regard to these odds. Another type of disorder is a dominant disorder. Here, if you have two genes, one normal and one abnormal, the disorder shows up. That is, a normal one doesn't compensate for the abnormal one. Huntington's disease or Huntington's chorea is one of the better known examples of this. And here the genetics works out such that if one of the parents has the disorder, there's a 50% risk on each child in terms of having the disorder. And in the case of something like Huntington's disease, the symptoms don't show up until in the 30s or so, and so often parents will go ahead and proceed with pregnancies before they even know if they indeed have Huntington's, that is, if one of their parents had Huntington's. And there isn't a test that you can do ahead of time to tell them whether the symptoms are going to show up. And then the last genetic situation is something called an X-linked disorder. It's called this because it's something that's carried on the X chromosome. Now remember, women have two X chromosomes, men have one X and a Y. It's a disorder so that if a normal one is paired with an abnormal one, you're safe. So women have an edge here because women have two X chromosomes. So if one of the X chromosomes carries a disorder and the other one's normal, the woman won't have the disorder. Men only have one X chromosome, so it's all or nothing. You don't have a carrier situation for men. Well, if we have the situation where we have the female who is a carrier, Duchenne muscular dystrophy and hemophilia are examples here, reproducing with the husband who doesn't have the disorder and, of course, wouldn't be a carrier because you don't have male carriers in a situation like this. It turns out that the sex of the child affects the risk factor. The two on the left with female children, half will be carriers, half won't be carriers. With male children, half will not have the disorder, half will have the disorder. So if you have a girl, no real risk of having a girl with a disorder. If you have a boy, there's a 50% chance of having the disorder. Okay, with those kinds of disorders, if the genetic counselor knows the situation with the prospective parents, they can provide this information. This is your risk factor. And they can also say something about the disorder and try to convey what the realities would be like of having a child with the disorder. There are other disorders that aren't a nice, clean genetic cross like the ones we've looked at. And one of the other examples is Down syndrome. Now, there are, as I mentioned, more than one type of Down syndrome, but the most common type, the one where you have just an extra chromosome number 21, the risk, one of the things that is related to the risk factor is the age of the mother. And this graph, if you look at the dark line going across, this is the risk factor for having a child with this particular kind of form of Down syndrome as a function of age of the mother. And you see, as it goes across and gets on toward about age 35, the slope increases fairly sharply, and the risk factor then goes up rather sharply, so that at age 45, the chances of having a child with Down syndrome go up to about 1 in 46. Okay, a genetic counselor can tell a couple this is the risk factor that you're looking at, but he or she can't tell the couple, are you going to be lucky or unlucky with your pregnancy if you proceed? Well, some couples will decide to take their chances And in some cases, there's a safety net available. That is, they can begin the pregnancy, and when the pregnancy is in progress, analysis can be done to determine if the fetus does in fact have the disorder that they're concerned about. And this is done by a procedure called amniocentesis, a procedure that's done about 16 weeks into the pregnancy. The diagram here indicates a needle is inserted into the amniotic sac, and about 20 cc's of amniotic fluid are taken out. In that fluid are a few cells, and some of them are live cells that have been sloughed off by the fetus. And so this material is removed, the cells are separated out. Sometimes the fluid will contain chemicals that will indicate an abnormality. There's something involved with spina bifida test where this shows up. But in most of the diagnoses, it's the cells that they're after. This is simply a picture of some amniotic fluid being removed. After the cells are obtained, then the cells are grown up in culture to get enough material to do the particular test that they're concerned about. On this slide are a number of the disorders that can be diagnosed following amniocentesis as to whether it's present in the fetus. All of the chromosome disorders can be detected because you can make one of those chromosome patterns like we saw earlier from the cells. Also, chemical tests for various of these disorders also can be done. This is only a partial list. There are about 70 different disorders for which there are tests, and the list is expanding rapidly. Right now, there's some work being done on trying to get a test for muscular dystrophy. We'll know probably in a year or so how reliable a particular test that they're exploring is. Another technique that is useful when the pregnancy is in progress is a technique called ultrasound. Ultrasound is essentially sonar. Sound waves are bounced off the placenta and the fetus, and an image of the fetus and placenta shows up on a screen and can provide useful information. Often ultrasound is used in combination with amniocentesis because you're sticking a needle into that amniotic sac. Obviously you want to stick the needle in a place where the fetus and placenta aren't. And so ultrasound is often used to locate the fetus and the placenta and to find out where a safe place is to insert the needle to get the amniotic fluid. Well, this is a little device called a transducer that scans the abdomen, and while this is going on, the woman and the physician can look up on a screen and see the pattern of the fetus that results. And here's one of those patterns. This is from several years ago. The resolution, the images you can now get from ultrasound are amazingly good. But for someone who is experienced, the pattern on the left is a normal pattern. The pattern on the right, there's labeled a small misshapen head. This is a fetus that has anencephaly, which means impaired development of the upper part of the spinal cord and of the brain. So there are some, if there is something structurally wrong with the fetus, some of these things can be detected by this method, and this method seems to be safe as far as anybody can tell. It's not like x-rays where there is a certain amount of damage. To show you how, well, I can't show you, but within the last week I saw some pictures in Science magazine of ultrasound of the fetus, and it was a study determining at what different kinds of eye movement the fetus makes at certain stages of development, and you could actually see the eyes clearly, whether they were open and closed and other resolutions. So although these pictures are fairly fuzzy, the technology is improving to an amazing degree.
One last technique that I'll just mention briefly, it's called fetoscopy. This is a highly experimental technique, and it's only used where something else can't do the job and there's a high risk of a genetic disorder. But basically, it's a way of directly looking at the fetus floating around there in the amniotic fluid. What happens is that a needle is inserted into the amniotic cavity, and it's hooked up in such a way it's kind of like a little flashlight in a way. You can look through there and see the fetus. Now, you can only see a part of the fetus at a time, but there are skin disorders. You can, if you're looking at the right part, you can see how many toes and fingers and look for other structural abnormalities. And the technique is also pretty interesting because if you look in the bottom left-hand corner, you can see around in there well enough that it's possible to take a needle and get a blood sample from the fetal vein on the placenta. And the reason why this is useful is if you can get a sample of fetal blood, there are certain genetic disorders, blood disorders in the fetus that you can diagnose with more reliability. Sickle cell anemia would be one such example. And so this expands the range of disorders that can be detected. The risk of doing this, though, is not at all insignificant. And there's only two places in the United States where this is done. And at the moment, about 10% of the time when this procedure is done, it triggers a miscarriage. And so it's not something to be done unless there is a very serious disorder that is expected to occur, and there isn't another method of detecting it. There's some speculation that with this fetoscopy, it may also open up some new methods of therapy for the fetus during pregnancy if there's some kind of a disorder, doing fetal surgery. In fact, a little bit of that has been done recently. I'll say a word about that. But also by being able to tap directly into the fetal blood system, perhaps medication of some kind can be provided. Some of you may have read about within the last month, there was a fetus that had a urinary blockage problem, and it was possible to go in, insert a little catheter, a little tube that allowed venting of the fluid. There was also a case of hydrocephaly, water on the brain building up. It was possible to go in and again insert a little tube into the brain where it drained off. And so these types of intervention will be increasingly available. That's most of the factual information. Now, of course, one of the issues that comes with this is that by doing all of this, particularly once the pregnancy is underway, the parents then get the information of the genetic condition of the fetus. And the reason for doing it is there is the implied implication in most cases that the parents are going to consider then whether to abort if the information is such that the fetus has a disorder in question. One of the issues, well, Jane has mentioned, and I'll bring up here too, is that when this technique is done and they do a chromosome analysis, not only do they get information in terms of does the fetus have Down syndrome, which might be the primary reason that the testing was done, but they also get information on the sex of the fetus. It's very easy to see if there's an X and a Y, or two X chromosomes. And so the sex of the fetus is a bit of information that the parents often have. And there are some who consider this an important factor as they look at an abortion decision. Did that stir you up at all? Would anyone care to
to raise a comment or a question, there are more things I can say, but I think we've got plenty of stuff for discussion here, yes.
No, but better than the female. One thing, the eggs, when a female is born, virtually all the eggs that are ever going to be potentially used to be the starting point for a new offspring are already there in the ovary. In the male system, they're continuously producing new sperm from sperm-producing cells. Now, there is, in fact, with the age of the male, the older the male, there is an increasing risk of certain dominant disorders. There can be genetic damage. The longer a person's around, the more we're exposed to agents that can trigger mutations. There is a certain frequency when cells reproduce of there being a mistake as well. And with the increased age of the father, there is an increased incidence of certain dominant disorders which probably arose by a mutation sometime during the lifetime of the father, and the longer the father was around, the greater the chance that this could happen. There's also some association between the age of the father and Down syndrome, which if the father's over 55 years of age, there seems to be an increased likelihood of a child with Downs. It isn't only associated with maternal age. And this, and another point that relates to this, because it's so well known that Down syndrome is related to maternal age, when a child is born with Down syndrome, there often is a tendency for the female to feel some sense of guilt in terms of being the source of the genetic disorder. You generally don't know when a child is born with Downs who that extra chromosome came from, and there are some studies indicating that maybe a quarter of the time at least that extra chromosome came from the male, and you don't know where it came from, and so there's no reason why the woman has to feel, I mean, no reason to feel guilty anyway, but I suppose it may be hard to avoid since I haven't been in the situation, but it can come from the male as well. I wish I had the data on this. Even though the risk factor is higher as age goes up, of course, generally those women have fewer children, and so if you look at the total number of Downs, how many came from which age groups, most of them do come from women under 40. It's just that the percentage of the pregnancies over 40 show a higher incidence of Downs. One thing on this, there is more than one kind of Down syndrome, and the kind we talked about, there's sort of a random chance occurrence of that extra chromosome showing up. But there is another kind. It's called a translocation, and if that's the kind of Down syndrome that a child has, that isn't a random occurrence. It means one of the parents has an unusual genetic situation, and it's an indicator that the parents should get some genetic counseling because they're looking at different risk factor than the general population if it's this other type of Down syndrome. This touches very closely to mandatory, well, there'd be a question of whether it'd be voluntary or mandatory. First of all, yeah, there was a program started in the early 1970s of mandatory genetic screening of blacks to find out who is a carrier for sickle cell anemia. The carrier condition is called sickle cell trait. And because it was mandatory, there was a considerable amount of resistance to it. In some states, young children in school were targeted as the age at which this had to be done. Knowing those who learned that they were carriers, there was not very good information about the carrier state. There was a feeling of inferiority, a feeling that maybe 1 out of 10 potential black mates would be incompatible, because that's about the odds of a black U.S. person being a carrier. It also triggered all kinds of problems. Life insurance companies raised their rates for people who were carriers. It's now become voluntary, and there's also a voluntary program for Tay-Sachs disease, which affects the Jewish population, and that's gone over very well.
So I think on a voluntary basis, there would be a place for that.
Yes.
Yeah, but it's not for genetic reasons, but are you saying perhaps you could tie that in? I think the United Nations passed a declaration of universal rights, some statement to the effect that every couple has the right to found a family, and you touch on a very interesting point of whether this is an inherent human right. When we talk about the gene pool problem downstream, if we were to ask how would we deal with this to the extent we think it's a serious problem, obviously placing certain restrictions on reproduction would be one of the approaches. Implementing it would be a hornet's nest, but it would certainly be before conception, you can test the prospective parents to see if they're carriers for certain disorders. There are those tests available, yes. Then they know what risk factor they're dealing with, right? But we're talking too about, since amniocentesis isn't done, really can't be done until about 16 weeks, and it takes generally maybe 2-3 weeks for the results to get back from the laboratory. If abortion is being considered, we're looking at about a 20-week. Well, the Supreme Court has basically said up until the time of viability, which is generally taken to be 24 to 28 weeks, although that's going to come under considerable attack because the time of viability keeps getting younger and younger as our technology improves.